Somewhere in the region of 200,000 people have been killed in a land war going on right now in Europe, the war in Ukraine. It's been going on in its full-scale version for the last 2 years and really dates back at least a decade. We're living in historic times with that kind of conflict going on, and it's easy to overlook it because for us, it's everyday life. Your world is changing in important ways. And today I wanted to step back and look at that in more detail. And one of the biggest, most important ways that this war in Ukraine is changing your world is the way that it is changing Europe. Europe is going through a historic shift. And this shift has happened small step by small step. But over the course of 2 years already, we have seen revolutionary changes. Right on the day of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine 2 years ago, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote, "The most important nation to watch right now is Germany. How will it respond to Putin's war on Ukraine? This Ukraine war is going to speed up the rise of the prophesied German-led Holy Roman Empire." And we've been making this point for decades about how Russia is going to transform Europe. Here's what Herbert W. Armstrong said in 1982.
"Now, one of the great things that is urging Europe on, and perhaps the greatest thing that will cause them to hurry and get together on this, is their fear of what's going on in the Kremlin and the Soviet Union. And Andropov is frightening them. And that is going to rush them. They are losing confidence in the United States as having a military umbrella over them to protect them. And they want their own military force to protect themselves. That's the way they feel over there. Now, that is a chief incentive to unite them, and that is taking place."
In 2008, Mr. Flurry asked, "Will a crisis occur over Ukraine? That area is the breadbasket of Russia, and surely it is willing to wage war over that as well." We've seen that play out exactly as he brought up there. In 2017, he wrote, "The Ukraine crisis continues, and America is sleeping through it, but Europe is deeply alarmed. The changes this crisis provokes in Germany and Europe will shake the nations." Back in 2022, as soon as that invasion happened, we got a dramatic reaction from Germany, with Chancellor Olaf Scholz announcing a massive change to the German military with a new 100 billion euro fund. But today I wanted to step back and look, have these statements from Mr. Flurry, from Mr. Armstrong, been proven true? How much have we seen Europe change already from this conflict? And to help me do that, I'm joined today by Joshua Michels. Joshua, good afternoon.
Hello.
So what we've decided to do is we're going to kind of go backwards and forwards a little bit, and we'll present to you 10 ways that Europe has been changed by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. We'll take it in turns to present a different change. We'll have some time to discuss it, and then look at the next way. And I think, just like we were, you'll be quite impressed at how much Europe is changing already based on this conflict. Before we launch into our 10 points, though, do you have any initial thoughts on this subject?
Yeah, just watching it at the time on the news and the media, how people responded. And you remember that the military build-up around Ukraine has been happening for days and weeks. But when they actually attacked, people were quite shocked. And Germany was shocked specifically. People were like, how could that happen? We had decades of peace. We have been cooperating with Russia for such a long time. But now the initial reaction of the German people, of the population, the common people, was fear. They were astounded by what was happening. A large-scale war on the continent. And that fear has transformed Germany more than anything else. But then there was also something very unusual where Eastern European countries were looking to Germany specifically, where Poland had its airspace secured by German airplanes or was getting other help in that way. And Romania and some of those other countries were looking to Germany in an unusual way, because in a moment of fear, we just didn't know at the time, is Ukraine going to fall in days? And if so, what's Russia going to do next? People were just afraid at the time.
I think that's a really good point. And that's perhaps not completely encapsulated by our top 10 list, because we're looking at ways that Europe has changed. What we saw in the days after the invasion was what people do in a crisis. And the fact that in this crisis, everyone turns to Germany is really revealing. But not necessarily one of the ways I get. I mean, it relates. We've got in there the way that Europe is looking to Germany to defend for defense. But that's a really good point as well, that next time you get another crisis, you will see everybody immediately turn to Germany once again. And I think, I mean, that's the value, I think, of this subject. Like, for Trumpet World, so often we're looking forwards. Like, it's a show all about Bible prophecy, about what is going to happen next. But sometimes that means that we don't appreciate how much has already happened. And I think that is important, to go back to look at how much has already happened, because then you realize where you are in the pace of a prophetic event. We're not sitting around waiting for stuff to happen, and none of that stuff has happened yet. Like, so many of the things that we've been talking about, that Herbert W. Armstrong was talking about decades ago, they have already happened. We're not waiting for prophecy to be fulfilled. We are in the midst of prophecy being fulfilled. And I think that's what we really hope to get across today. Did you want to kick things off then with your first point, the first way we've seen Europe change in response to this?
Yes, that's right. And that's the massive increase in funding for Germany's military. And that's one of those points where people look back on it and they try to marginalize it. But at the moment, it was absolutely massive. Olaf Scholz, the German Chancellor, stepped forward and announced that Germany is going to have a special fund for its military of 100 billion euros. Now, at the time, Germany was spending 50 billion on its defense budget, and that's already one of the largest military spendings in the world. And Germany is one of the largest economies in the world and has access to the best military industry in the world, both of the United States and in home in Europe itself. So they said we will have a special fund in addition to our defense fund of 100 billion to increase our military stockpile. Now, sometimes Germany is compared to Israel because it has one of the most modern armed forces and also access to Western technology. And Israel only spends about 23 billion at the time in 2022 when this was announced. 23 billion is a lot of money, but only half of Germany's defense budget. But if you look at what Israel can do with that defense budget, it has to defend its borders all the time. It has to defend itself against rocket attacks all the time. It has to keep an active military going all the time. Germany has none of that. It hasn't been invaded for decades. It doesn't have a threat around its corner. In fact, it's cooperating military with all those countries around it. It's sharing military technology. So to have 100 billion to just increase its defense budget is a large sum.
And I think another country that we can kind of put it in context with is Russia itself. And you go back before the Ukraine invasion, because Russia's defense spending has really catapulted over the last year or two. You go back before then, 2021, Russia was spending about 65 billion on its military. Germany was spending about 55 billion. So you add in the 100 billion special fund and you add in all this extra that Germany is spending, and suddenly Germany has become a bigger military spender than Russia used to be. And you look at what Russia did with their military budget, the way that Russia made the whole world tremble. And was really the focus of, say, anti-American or anti-Western fighting or thought for the world, leadership for the world. Germany is now spending what Russia used to spend. That's a massive potential shift. And then even the shift in balance between France and Germany, where historically you kind of had this thing where Germany is the economic power in Europe. They have the money, but France has the military. And France, of the two, is the bigger military spender. France has the kind of the legacy of empire that's still intact, and they've got all the military bases across North Africa. And that, I think, is something that has shifted since the Ukrainian invasion, where Germany's taking on more of the military leadership of Europe. They have the money to spend more easily than France. France is kind of in chaos right now, in part because of its budget. Like, they haven't got a prime minister. They're struggling. Like, they need to cut costs. Germany's becoming the financial leader. France is getting kicked off of its African bases. It's having major problems in North Africa with its former. So we're seeing military leadership shift away from France and towards Germany, which I think is not necessarily an outcome you'd expect based on Russia invading one of their neighbors.
Yeah, I mean, it is a transformative moment for Europe like we haven't seen during the Cold War, because there was not war on the continent. France also increased their military budget, but they just don't have the resources, and they have to have those military bases around the world, and they have a nuclear arsenal they have to take care of. So Germany just can invest differently, and also the German location is quite differently than France, where it's surrounded with other nations where it can cooperate.
And that European dimension is important. Like, I think the shift in power, like they were just talked about. But so 2022 combined EU defense spending was 240 billion euros, so $260 billion. Let's try and stick with dollars for now, I guess. 2023, $300 billion. So already a 40 billion increase in a year, and then 2024 it's projected to be 378 billion. So in just 2 years we've gone from 260 billion to 380 billion. Kind of a 50% increase in defense spending. And that is huge. And back when we were on Trumpet Hour, it kind of almost became a slight running joke that Poland was becoming a military superpower. Because Poland went on this insane shopping spree. Over 1,000, I think it might even be in the thousands now, of cheaper older tanks from South Korea. They were buying hundreds of the latest Abrams tanks from America, F-35 fighter jets, new combat air defense system. They're now the biggest military spender in NATO as a proportion of their economy. I think they're coming to around 4% with the latest military spending. So you've had, it's not, Germany's taken the military leadership, but a lot of all these other countries have gone on these pretty big shopping sprees.
Yeah, and the amazing thing about that is too, if you start militarizing, you have access to technology that has been tested all the time. America had to sustain its military stockpile. You had to store weapons for so many years. All that storage costs adds up. The military bases costs adds up. And Europe has been benefiting from that. They didn't have to do all of those things because they had that military umbrella from America. And now they're coming up and they're buying stockpiles from America. Weapons that have been tested, the weapons that have been developed over those years, and suddenly you can have a military power just like that.
At risk of talking about everything inside our first point and leaving nothing for later on, I think that related to that, you've got this so-called backfilling thing. Well, this was more in the first year of the Ukraine conflict, where you had nations like the former Eastern Bloc nations, Poland, Romania, I think, did this, maybe the Czech Republic or Slovakia, where you have these former Soviet countries that have a whole bunch of, or former communist countries that have a whole bunch of Soviet equipment. Then they've joined NATO, and now they've got new NATO equipment. And of course, like, all of the NATO equipment is designed to work together, but the Soviet MiGs and whatever, they're not. And so what they did was give a lot of the old Soviet equipment to Ukraine and then replace it or backfill it with newer American, often NATO equipment. So you had very quickly Eastern Europe have a rapid upgrade of their military. You know, they gave the hand-me-downs to be used in Ukraine. And so it did help Ukraine. It made their military more powerful, but it made all of Eastern Europe's military more powerful, largely paid for by the United States. I think some of these might be loans and they might be paid back, but I think a lot of that was marketed as aid for Ukraine. I think America was giving these countries very hefty discounts. So that was an immediate step up in the military capacity of just about all of Eastern Europe.
And actually Germany, they called it Ringtausch, but they did something similar. They said, we don't want to send weapons to Ukraine. They can't handle the technology or whatever they said at the time, which didn't prove to be true in the end. But they sent to Poland, you sent your Soviet tanks, or to Hungary or to other European countries. And then they sent Western technology to those countries, which then could cooperate with the German military.
So massive increase in German military spending, massive increase in all of Europe's military spending. But moving on to point number two, one of the other big things there's been a lot of discussion about with this invasion is nuclear war. For a conflict between two neighbors, one of which isn't nuclear, It is very interesting how important nuclear discussions have been to this Ukrainian conflict, and it's raised fears of nuclear war and then discussions of other countries getting nuclear weapons and some quite remarkable developments in moving towards nuclear weapons all across Europe. So there've always been this discussion of, if things go really bad, is Russia going to resort to nuclear weapons? And I think some of those discussions are still ongoing. That's still a possibility, as you see Ukraine invading Russia's own territory. Could you see something like that? But then also Russia has been using, I think it's their Iskander missiles, Kyber hypersonic. I'll put that in scare quotes. I'm not sure I believe Russia that they're actually hypersonic at this point. There's some evidence they're not quite as good as Russia claims they are. But they've been using missiles that are capable of carrying nuclear weapons against Ukraine, just not been equipping them with nuclear weapons, which has blurred the line between short-range ballistic missiles. Are they nuclear? Are they not? That's something that makes people very worried, this increasing use of short-range missiles, because they can carry nuclear weapons, and then they, you know, an intercontinental ballistic missile goes all the way into space and back down again. It gives you more time to respond. Short and medium-range missiles have a very different flight path, and so you have dramatically less time to decide, is this a nuclear attack? Is it something else? So you've had a lot of discussion on nuclear weapons, I think most noticeably between France, Germany, and then maybe Poland. Poland being closest to Russia, some of these Baltic states, they're the most in the firing line, they're some of the most afraid. So the Polish president, he brought up in an interview on April 22nd that he'd be willing to host US nuclear weapons. I think it's not a coincidence that 5 or 6 days later, the French president Emmanuel Macron came out with his solution of having a nuclear European nuclear deterrent independent of the United States. And he said that France was ready to contribute more to the defense of Europe. And if you're looking at the European Union, while a lot of countries in the EU have American nuclear weapons, and discussion about those and even training and use of those has stepped up since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So you've got Germany, the Netherlands, Italy, Turkey, I believe it is, they've all got about 150 to 200 American nuclear bombs stationed on those bases. But then you've had these discussions with France offering, well, no, we'll provide the nuclear umbrella, and then we're independent of the United States. And that's a big, I think it's a big symbolic cut. These nuclear bombs have been sitting in German and Turkish and Italian military bases for decades. It seems almost certain to me that the authorities that control those bombs by now will have the ability to use them without America's permission. But still, there's this symbolic kind of, okay, well, we're dependent on America in extremis for our ultimate survival. Of everything, if all the chips fall down, it's America that's providing our nuclear bombs. And it's really interesting to see Emmanuel Macron trying to cut that cord and say, no, we want to stand alone. We want to be separate from the United States. And then there's been a lot of internal discussion in Germany about, what do we do here? Yeah, we kind of wouldn't like to be dependent on the United States. Is the France offer a better option? Should we have an independent German nuclear power? There have been that debate. And then the other major development of this is what Germany is spending some of that $100 billion on. And a big chunk of that went to purchasing American F-35 fighter jets that will carry the American nuclear bombs that are in Germany. And that's kind of their whole purpose of buying these fighter jets. Which means you have, and that's a big step up in capability for Germany. If you're a really dedicated listener, you might remember 5-6 years ago, I was doing shows on the flaws of the F-35. And these are an insanely expensive weapon system. And there were some ridiculous problems where they didn't even test the cybersecurity of the spare parts ordering system because they were afraid it would ground the entire fleet. That is a problem that should not be happening in top-of-the-line fighter jets. Setting that aside, these are also stealth fighter jets that can carry nuclear bombs. That's a massive upgrade for Germany's ability. So they could have nuclear weapons on a stealth plane, and they've got that as deterrent. So all of that is all coming after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and all of this discussion about how do we cope with nuclear war. I almost forgot the more recent one about America now stationing medium-range ballistic missiles within Germany. That's caused a bit of a ruckus within Germany. Again, they're not carrying nuclear weapons, but intermediate-range missiles form part of this whole nuclear discussion. So there's a big uptick in, say, nuclear fear going on within all of Europe right now.
Yeah, and World War II ended with nuclear weapons, and has often been said that the Third World War will start with nuclear weapons. But in the span between, those nuclear weapons have changed significantly in much greater power. And with stealth fighter jets and hypersonic missiles, their power is much greater now, but also to the point of Germany wanting to build their own bombs. That's an option. It was the German defense minister, Franz Josef Strauß, early on said, we need our own nuclear weapons. America didn't want to allow that, so he got them to station American nuclear weapons. But then afterwards, he invested in nuclear energy. So you have those nuclear enrichment facilities to enrich the uranium, and then you increase, and then you have the electrical grid connected to the power plants. But Germany has some of the most advanced enrichment facilities. So if they wanted to, they could enrich the uranium easily to that weapons grade that Iran is struggling with, but they have been at that threshold now too. And then added to that, Germany has been cooperating with France on their nuclear program to have the weapon system for them. And they have been sending nuclear capable submarines to Israel. So they have some of the weapon system that can be armed with nuclear weapons, just like the F-35. They also have the Tornado fighter jet that they've been using right now. And they have been testing the use of those American nuclear bombs. So if you look at every single facet, what you need from building your own bomb, from enriching the uranium, to actually dropping the bomb, Germany could do all of that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. Like, Germany is a nuclear power. It's a polite fiction that they're not counted among the official nuclear powers. They have everything that they need to be able to do that. And then, so there's the Germany becoming more nuclear angle, but also, I mean, a European Union that does nuclear defense for its member states, the way Emmanuel Macron is talking about it, that would be a huge step towards European unity. I mean, that's partly why it hasn't happened so far. That is a big step, but we're getting much closer to that. And that, I mean, I think that fundamentally would change the relationship between European member states if it's not just about we're a trading relationship, but we're relying on this union for our survival in all-out war. And so I think that angle is also very important. But of course, it's not just nuclear weapons. Conventional weapons have had a major uptick in over the last couple of years. And I believe that's the subject of your third point.
Yes, so Germany has been buying weapon systems from America, but at the same time, there's a strong push to invest at home too. So there's a stronger focus on the German or the European arms industry, even with the F-35. Rheinmetall said, well, we can't just buy the F-35 from America. We actually have to cooperate with them to produce part of it in Germany. So they built a F-35 center fuselage plant in Germany. It's a very different word in German, so I struggle with that one. But it's one of the core parts of the plane. And actually, lots of the weapon systems of that F-35 are in that part of the plane that will be produced in Germany. And that plant will be producing 400 of those parts. So for 400 planes for Germany and other allied NATO nations. So it's a major cooperation that just resulted from that Ukraine war, from that increased focus on the arms industry. But then separate from that, after Olaf Scholz announced his 100 billion euros, which is approximately the same in dollars, he also later on met with the arms industry looking how fast they can deliver. And again, Rheinmetall said, we can deliver you very soon 47 billion worth of equipment, ammunition, helicopters, armed vehicles. And Rheinmetall is the biggest arms manufacturer. Now Airbus is a European one, and they are more in the aerial military sector, but also in the civilian one. But the purely German one is Rheinmetall. They also had ThyssenKrupp Marine System, that said we can update your fleet, and they had Hensoldt. They said we can update your radar system. So you have a lot of arms manufacturers who suddenly came forward. We can suddenly exponentially increase our arms manufacturing to arm those troops. And they were actually disappointed to not get as many orders from that 100 billion as they would have liked to. But that's another big story where they said, we can deliver so much, we can shift our production from producing part of the day to production night and day to arm you, we are ready to go.
The turnaround for European arms companies has been really, really remarkable. And I wouldn't recommend using Bible prophecy to try and get rich on the stock exchange. If you tried that, if you did though, and if you used some of Mr. Flurry's statements at the start of the Ukrainian war as investment advice, you could have gotten pretty rich. If you look at Rheinmetall's share price, for example, you go back to February 2022, right before Vladimir Putin invades Ukraine, and it was about 100 euros a share, just under 100 euros a share. It peaked at about 550 euros a share earlier this month. Like, the share price has gone up more than fivefold, getting even close to sixfold for Rheinmetall. That company is now six times more valuable than it was before Russia invaded Ukraine. That really is remarkable. Part of the reason why is exactly that, like, their change in ammunition or their change in military production. And it is, in a lot of it, it's the boring numbers. Like, it's not necessarily, it's important to recognize, yeah, the big eye-catching F-35 discussions about the Leopard 3 battle tank, the latest version of the Abrams tank, but also just gets back to being as simple as shell production. Like, Rheinmetall shell production is increasing at an astonishing rate. So before the war in Ukraine, they sold about 70,000 shells a year. Now they're looking at producing 700,000 shells a year. And then they've built a new factory in Germany. They've been breaking ground on ammunition I think several different ammunition factories. There's one planned in Lithuania. They're aiming to produce 1.5 million shells a year. So we've gone from 70,000 to 1.5 million. All of Europe, that's just one company. All of Europe is looking at ramping up its ammunition production. And this is the nuts and bolts of building a military power.
Yeah, and we have seen that in the Ukraine war a lot, because we have moved on from previous wars where you have large-scale war, you have all those tanks and you have machine guns and all those bullets they're going through. If you just pull the trigger for a few seconds, you have dozens and dozens and hundreds of ammunition flying through the air, and to get the drones down and to get through a tank, Russia had to drastically increase it. And that was the biggest thing that also held back Ukraine from advancing, was just the amount where they have to use their ammunition sparingly. And the changes that Rheinmetall are making are there to stay. For example, it also bought a Spanish ammunition manufacturer. So the orders that they're getting helped them expand and getting bigger. And of course, they're building also new tanks. They had the new Panther tank. That's also something they have been looking at Ukraine and seeing what are the lessons we can learn from that war. Not just the ammunition needs, but also the being protected for drone warfare, being protected from mines. So they are learning all those lessons from Ukraine, and they are able to incorporate them right away.
And that is something I think we'll look a little more at, some of the ways that lots of countries around the world are learning lessons from the Ukraine war when it comes to their military production. Our fourth point relates to some of these lessons from the Ukraine war, and that is we're seeing Germany reorganize its military. So this got started pretty quickly, June 2022, within the first year of the war. The then German defense minister, Christina Lambrecht, she announced a new military command center to unite different command structures. There was a big focus around 2023 on streamlining the bureaucracy. Like, Ukraine really drove home to people the need for military to be able to move quickly. You know, you don't want all of these paperwork and getting things signed in triplicate, gumming things up. So they worked to completely streamline that. And then in April this year, you had a pretty radical revamp of the country's military to prepare it for war. So the defense minister Boris Pistorius came out and talked about how they wanted to make Germany more war capable. The Associated Press wrote at the time that this is a choice of words that some in Germany find jarring, given the country's long-standing post-World War II culture of military caution. But Pistorius you know, he was very insistent that those were the right words. He said, I'm convinced it is one of the few words that really describes the imperative here. You know, he was revamping the entire military around the need for full-scale war. You saw homeland security forces being absorbed into the army. That's something that was kept separate after World War II. It was kind of like, well, we don't want to allow any potential government to be able to use the army to impose its will at home. And that was something that was eroded bit by bit over the years. I mean, even as recently as, say, COVID, or you'd have some flood disasters, and they say, well, okay, we do need to have, we need to get rid of these barriers to using the military at home so they can help with rebuilding and protecting people in a flood. Or even, I think there were some things around COVID mandates, if I remember correctly.
Vaccines.
Yeah, vaccine mandates. But now it's, well, we're going to fully unify these. Because Germany's looking at what happened to Ukraine and the way that they fought to defend themselves. And I think to me, it's a fascinating takeaway from this Ukraine war, where they said, okay, we want to create a cyber command as a fourth branch of military. You know, we've got the army, we've got the navy, we've got the air force, we've got the cyber command. That's a pretty heavy emphasis on cyber command. And no one really has that. I mean, China kind of has... it's People Liberation Army Strategic Surface Support Force is what they call it. That's one of its five branches, but that also includes outer space, political and propaganda warfare. It's not quite the same thing as Cyber Command, but that was one of their takeaways. And Boris Pistorius said that, well, there's no war, there's hardly any combat situation that we've seen in Ukraine where digital command and control capability does not play a central role in ensuring that a battle can be won. So they've really put a focus on artificial intelligence, on cyber hacking, and we have seen some of this in the Ukraine war, on winning the digital information war. And they say we need to elevate that in our command structure as we make the German military more prepared for war. So, you know, just Germany making its military more prepared for war, I think, is a fulfilled forecast from what we have talked about in the introduction there. It's a way Germany's military is changing. But Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry really drew attention to the potential for cyber warfare. Our big long-term forecast is you're going to see Europe rising up and replacing Britain and the United States and the West, as the leaders of the Western order, as the leaders of the world, and that they're going to ultimately take down the United States as the number one superpower. And one of the prophecies that talks about this in Ezekiel, it says, they've blown the trumpet even to make all ready, but none goes to the battle, for my wrath is upon the multitude thereof. That you have a conflict and the American military basically doesn't show up. And Mr. Flurry wrote, the trumpet of war is going to be blown in Israel. And like we've talked about a lot on this show, modern Israel, that's Britain and America, as well as Israel in the Middle East. But he continues there, it seems everybody's expecting our people to go into battle, but the greatest tragedy imaginable occurs. Nobody goes to battle, even though the trumpet is blown. Will it be because of computer terrorism? And he was pointing all the way back in the 1990s and saying, well, watch for Germany to develop in this specific way, cyber warfare. Because the Bible talks about it taking America and Britain down in this fashion that sounds very much like modern computer warfare. And we've seen Germany pivot to focus on that more as a result of the Ukrainian invasion and the Ukrainian war. A very specific fulfilled prophecy, I think, that we're seeing there. But that overall point, Germany is reorganizing its military, it's getting ready for war. I mean, that's an important part of how they've responded to the invasion of Ukraine.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to highlight what you just said, because it's not something you're going to see on the surface when you look at how many tanks does Germany have, how many airplanes does Germany have. But in a way, it's more important than that, because in our digitalized world, a cyber terrorist attack can change the battlefield. It can change who advances and who won't advance. Because if America can't go to war, it doesn't matter how many planes they have in their airfield. It doesn't matter if they have the advanced tank if you can't switch it on. And Germany has some of the advanced tanks too, but you only need a handful of them to actually then advance, because the civilian people, they can't defend themselves against one of those tanks. So to take over a city, you can take it over with one tank if none of that military technology works. And with the 100 billion, 16 billion, I believe it was, that they invest in digitalization of the troops. 16 billion of the 100 billion, that's a massive amount of just one specific purchase. And you can't even track it down. In the end, you will see not much change because of it. And also, historically, Germany has been operating more secretly than any other military because they don't want to be seen as the aggressor. They like the surprise attack. And that cyber terrorism fits in with that exactly. They don't want to be seen as the threat that has so many airplanes that they can deploy suddenly. But if they can surprise the enemy with that, that's going to really help them in the end in the long run.
I think those are all really important points. The other aspect of the story about Germany reorganizing its military that I think you've followed a bit more than I have over the summer is this new report from the Bundeswehr Inspector General, which the Bundeswehr Inspector General sounds kind of like a clerk, or like it doesn't sound like an important job, but they're basically the head of the German army. It is a very important job. But he came out with this speech, wasn't it, where he was telling recruits, 2029, we want to have a complete revamp of our military, and we want to have all of these radical new capabilities by 2029.
Yeah, and his name is Carsten Breuer, and he was actually in charge.
Yeah, I didn't want to try and say that. That's why I left that for you.
He was actually in charge of administering the vaccines to people in the coronavirus crisis for the Bundeswehr's sake. And he has the highest military rank, and it's supposed to be subordinate to the government because Germany, they said we need a democracy after World War II. The military can't be in charge. But the new defense minister actually made a change to that slightly where he said, well, they can't be in charge, but I allow him to advise me. And I basically followed his advice. So in essence, he put the military back in charge of the military. So if he says we need so much military equipment, he says, well, I will be your advocate instead of I will be your restraint. And that man says, which is very much the same that the defense minister says, we have to be ready for large-scale warfare in 2029. And it builds on some of the Cold War plans where Germany was like the center between a Western war and war with the East, and Germany was to become the battleground, so they invested a lot in West Germany to be able to mobilize troops, and they want to put a step up on that. For example, one of the German highways that goes from west to east, you have to be able to move 800,000 troops, they say. And to do that, you have to have all the civilian companies that can help, they need to help. So it's more of a civilian cooperation with the arms industry, with the military, to make a large-scale mobilization possible. So again, that's based on some of the Cold War plans, but they're adapting it to new realities, and they're basically saying that we need all of the civilian industry to cooperate with us to make this happen.
And that's, I think, another really important point. I mean, it's like, there's a saying, amateurs talk tactics while professional soldiers, professional generals talk logistics. And that's kind of what we've done here. We've spent the last however long we've been doing this, 20, 30 minutes, talking about weapon systems and tactics and strategy. And all of that is important, but perhaps equally important is just the infrastructure. Like, can your roads transport soldiers east? Do you have enough transport planes? What arrangements are in place to feed an army, to fuel an army? That is critical. And it's important to note, okay, it's not as eye-catching as Germany buying stealth planes that can drop nuclear bombs, but it is also very critical, and they're really putting a lot of emphasis on that as well. And there's, I think, NATO, they were doing this before the war, they've stepped this up during the war, efforts to unify things like track gauges and have maps where you can know where you can drive large vehicles from France all the way to Poland, and you know which bridges are capable of supporting that tank, and you're not going to smash into the side of a tunnel and all of these things. Like, the boring details you need to move troops around quickly. They're getting that sorted. They're getting that sorted for moving them around Europe. the EU is investing a lot in its airlift capacity. That is happening. That is happening as well. But that European dimension, I think that brings us to the fifth point. And this, I think this in some ways is the big underreported story of the decade, this fifth point. But this is also something that has kicked into higher gear just in the last couple of years.
Yeah, military cooperation with other European countries. Germany, again, is at the center of it. So they can cooperate with the countries around them. One big story that we have been highlighting on just last year, the last Dutch combat brigade joined a German division. So basically, if they go to war, that Dutch combat brigade will go to war under German leadership.
Yeah, like Germany has swallowed the entire Dutch army.
Basically, like the combat brigade, is that what would defend the country in the end? And they said, well, Germany invaded us before, they are our biggest threat. So why just don't we just cooperate with them so we eliminate a threat so they just voluntarily submit? In World War II, they just basically let the German troops go through, and there was a lot of cooperation like that before then. But this is major. What's major too is what led up to it. They had military training facilities. They had language programs. So it was decades to allow that synergy. Now again, when someone looks at Germany and counts the military brigades, the combat brigades they have, they wouldn't count the Dutch ones, but the Dutch ones are basically part of Germany already.
And then I think it's Romania and I think the Czech Republic.
Yes.
There's combat brigades. So it's all the Dutch army, basically, all of their land forces. And then there's, I think it's like a tank brigade from those other two. And Germany's talked about this as this is a model for what we want to do throughout Europe. Like, everyone has this opportunity. And I think for the Dutch, it was like 2/3 of their army had joined before the Ukrainian invasion. And then it was the final Dutch combat brigade that joined after the Ukrainian invasion. So it's really stepping up this European-wide process of military unification.
And yeah, and NATO has played a huge role in that too, because Germany was not allowed to have a military, and then NATO came along, and you have all those other militaries suddenly cooperating with Germany, and now they have all those military exercises, which I want to talk about one more here, which comes to the land exercises too, but this one was the Air Defender 2023, and was the largest air exercise in the history of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So throughout the Cold War, they never had such a military exercise as far as the air forces are concerned. And who led the exercise? It was Germany. And actually, I have a clip here from the United States General Michael Lowe, who was asked about that. Like, why does Germany is leading that large exercise, the largest in NATO history, if we can play that one.
Why is it German-led?
I'm not sure why it's German-led, to tell you the truth. I know that Germany wanted to lead an exercise to test both their ability to host forces and their also their ability to do full NATO interoperability.
I just love that quote because he's basically saying, I don't know, they just asked and they want to test how they can work with other militaries together. So I didn't see any problem with it and let it go. That's it.
And that's something they keep doing. Like, there's I talked about this on Trumpet, the Week in Review show, either last Friday or the Friday before, where Germany is building a new base, their first overseas permanent military base in Lithuania. And I think they volunteered to take the lead in at least one NATO task force for the Baltics. And then there was a top German admiral who was over in Japan, you know, being interviewed, doing the normal press interviews. And he kind of brought up out of the blue, like, hey, we're up for commanding all of the NATO forces in the Baltic. Will do all of their navies. Again, it's just kind of a lot. That caught a lot of people by surprise. Why is Germany volunteering out of the blue to take on this task? But they are really stepping up, leading the different multinational groups within NATO in a way that no one else really is.
Yeah, I think I remember a quote from Churchill where he said Germany doesn't have 10,000 military soldiers, it has 10,000 generals. Because what they're doing is they're preparing their people to be the leaders. And the troops this time are not just the German troops, but they are also the ones from the other European countries. And I want to talk one more example from Finland. When Finland joined NATO, Germany was pushing for Finland to join NATO, but the first thing they did, the day of it joined, it led a military exercise together with them. The Finnish and the Portuguese and the German forces had like a military exercise under German General Admiral Thorsten Marx.
And That's been another direct consequence of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, is we've had Sweden and Finland join NATO. You know, it's made the Baltic this NATO lake. It's given a big opportunity for NATO to push closer to Russia. It is really interesting to see Germany capitalize on that. Well, for my sixth point, I've done what I was afraid I would do, where I've completely stolen, I think, this entire point by jumping in on this point too early, and that is Germany moving east. So just like we talked about, Germany, they announced back in December, or they signed the deal that they'd be permanently stationing 5,000 troops in Lithuania. I mean, that breaks this major taboo for the German military. It's just about the last major taboo, having them stationed there. I think Peter Zeihan made a video at the time back in December that was really good. We can play a clip from that.
That now seems to be going by the wayside, and the Germans are finally developing capabilities. Now, 5,000 troops in Lithuania is not the end of the world, but it does mean the rehabilitation of Germany as a more normal country that has military tactics and strategies as part of the toolkit, just like any other country. And because of that, the Germans will start having opinions on security issues. Now, in the short term, this is a broadly good thing for the European alliance, because most of the concerns are around Russia and Ukraine, and everyone's more or less on the same page there. But the Russians starting to pick up guns and do things with guns that other countries do, this reminds me of the last seven major wars that the Germans were in. There was a period of disarmament if they lost, and then it ended, and the Germans started using military tactics again, and stuff got real really, really fast. So, are the Germans our enemies? No, not today. Will the Germans start to see the world a little bit differently? Oh yeah. And has that ever ended well? Oh, no.
So that's an important point. I thought it was also just really interesting. You look at right around the same time, Germany kind of worked with Ukraine to upset the Polish elections. You look, it looks like they backed Ukraine in this dispute with Polish farmers over grain prices. It ended up undermining support for the main Polish political party that was pretty anti-German. They wanted to build up the Polish military. They didn't really like the leadership role that Germany was having in Europe and German-backed media and things like that to help swing this election in favor of Donald Tusk, this former EU politician. It was right after that election that the Lithuanian deal was signed, because who's between Germany and Lithuania? It's Poland. You need Poland on board, I think, for that kind of the logistical chain for that German base in Lithuania to really be viable. So you look at the Germany commanding the NATO fleet, Germany's influence in Poland, this military base in Lithuania. You are really seeing Germany take on that leading role of defense in Eastern Europe and push east. And then, Joshua, I think you have another point that we kind of spoiled a little bit earlier, but I think we did leave a little bit more for you to talk about on this seventh point than I left myself on point six.
It is one of maybe the most controversial points I want to bring up, but I feel quite strongly about it, and it's Germany testing weapons in Ukraine. Now, if you understand some of the back history between World War I and World War II, Germany was not allowed to test weapons, to manufacture weapons. So they did some of that in Russia with building testing facilities there and sending weapons to be tested there. And before 2014, Rheinmetall was working on a large scale testing facilities. It's like the largest in the world. This is not built in Russia, but Russia is building, we're testing its weapon system and strategies. But Germany has also been sending weapons directly to Ukraine. And now the question is, why is that? For example, Rheinmetall has built a factory there to be able to repair damaged vehicles, damaged tanks that Ukraine is using, like the Leopard tank they are using. Now, every time a tank gets damaged, you learn from it. Where did it get damaged? What's its most vulnerable point? How can we strengthen that point, that things like that don't happen again? How can we protect it from drone warfare? So tanks are a big thing. Drone warfare is a big thing. But I really want to focus today mainly, and it's a little bit of a niche again, but it's AI. Artificial intelligence. So the Times wrote an article, for example, in February, that the Ukraine has become an AI war lab. Now, that's the most traumatic situation, I think, in Ukraine right now, as far as what kind of military ramification it has for larger scale wars. what's tested in Ukraine will be the tools that will be used on a larger scale around the world in the future wars, because that's the opportunity people see now. How is AI transforming the military battlefield? Now, again, Germany was hesitant to actually send many of its heavy equipments that would have helped Ukraine gain a victory. But two companies I want to highlight here are that went directly to work in Ukraine, that don't help them to get the military advantage, but that are helping military innovation like no others. For example, the Helsing GmbH. Now, you may have never heard of it.
For the English listeners, Helsing, that other word you say that I'm not going to try and pronounce, that just means like Helsing Inc., basically, isn't it?
It's just saying this is a company. It's a boring acronym, and I can't even say the whole thing. But it's a German company, Munich-based. I think it was formed in 2020. No one knew, people really don't know about it, but it already got like large-scale projects from the German military about its new investment in the future of its air force, where they are working together with France and Spain, and they asked this company to do some of the work on artificial intelligence and things like that. So it's a significant company, even though it started just recently and nobody knows about it. But right at the beginning of the war, they said, hey, Ukraine, we are going to help you with your drones. We see that you're doing some drones here. Let us get technical with them. Let us see how we can help you using artificial intelligence to advance them. And they have an official agreement with the Ukrainian Strategic Industries Minister at the time. They made a formal agreement. We are cooperating on that. Another company is Quantum Systems, and they are actually selling Ukraine drones, and their reconnaissance drones. Now, again, you can use them for civil purposes, but you can also use them for military purposes. Ukraine gave the perfect opportunity to use them in the military scene, where they can spy where Russia is coming, and then Ukraine can prepare for that. So those are some crucial items where Germany is really testing material, trusting drone warfare, which they could have not done in any other way before. And that company also works with the US military, which shows that it's a system that they are producing that's used by the most modern armed forces in the world.
And it's not just Ukraine. Like, we're seeing a lot of new weapons in Ukraine, but you look at, say, the Azerbaijan-Armenia conflict that's been going on at the same time, not as high level. But drones have featured massively in that. I mean, a lot of countries around the world are starting to wake up and say, okay, the wars that we're fighting, they're not going to be a repeat of, say, America's invasion of Iraq. That some things have fundamentally shifted. And so it's very revealing to see Germany working hard to be on the cutting edge of that technology change and trying to learn everything that they can about how to deal with this new battle space and these new technologies.
Yeah, and drones, swarms of drones are said to be more dangerous than nuclear weapons in a way, because if you can produce tiny drones and you can produce millions of them at a small cost, and if you send all of them like a swarm on an aircraft carrier, that aircraft carrier that costs billions of dollars, it will have a hard time defending itself. How can it shoot down so many drones? If you then send a missile after the drone swarm, what's going to happen to that aircraft carrier?
Yeah, I mean, that's an important point, I think, that raises the stature of artificial intelligence. I mean, you know, you've kind of got this situation where I have a hard time not being a bit too jaded about AI, because so many businesses stick AI in their name or in their what they do, and it boosts their share price, and it's stupid and it's irrelevant. Like, that they just, it's purely branding, and I think it can kind of tarnishes AI's reputation as a whole. But really, you know, if you're spending 100 billion, is it, no, 100 million, let's say, on an F-35 fighter jet, you're not going to be buying many F-35 fighter jets. But if you're in this position where you're building drones for $10,000 or even less, you're going to be producing thousands upon thousands. How do you control them? If you've got a swarm of 10,000 drones, even 1,000 drones, you're not going to have a human operator on every single drone making target. So now you need computer technology that can respond swiftly. You know, this is what we're calling AI these days. So you need AI. Like that's kind of an automatic consequence of the changes that we're seeing in the battlefield. So, and it's not just drones, you know, it's the IT changing and using cyber hacking. And that now the fact that trying to interrupt your communication with your drones becomes a critical factor of my battlefield success. This technologizes everything. And it's part of, it goes together. Drones, artificial intelligence. We're seeing all of this play a much bigger role on the battlefield. And Germany's watching that closely.
Yeah, and they're also into regulations where they say, well, if artificial intelligence can decide who lives and not, that's dangerous. So they're saying, let's make an international agreement where everyone says we won't use this technology to kill people. But anyone who suggests such an agreement has to realize that people who want to use it for that purpose will not commit to that regulation, except maybe the United States, which they say, yeah, that's unethical and we can't do that. But it's always the one that suggests that regulation that should be watched most carefully.
That, I feel, is the trick that the EU always used on Britain. Like, they would make these rules and then everyone would ignore it apart from us, and it would...
Volkswagen had a huge scandal with the diesel emissions, but yeah, they just screwed up.
Or just see Italy. They just... whatever. They didn't like the rule, they just ignored it. We get it. This is a bit by the by. As we get into some of our last few points, these are changes, I think, that are in process, but maybe a bit more future-looking. And so my eighth point is that the Ukraine war has exposed Europe's leadership void. You can make all of these military changes, but really, you need a strong leader behind them. And I think you see that in Vladimir Putin and Volodymyr Zelensky in Ukraine. I'm not holding up either of these people really as great men, certainly not on the same level as someone like Winston Churchill, but just in the fact that they are, say, strong personalities and visible personalities, I think we could accurately characterize both of them as that way. That's what it takes to wage a war. And sure, it's not going, Putin, there's a lot of people saying, well, Putin made a mistake in even starting this in the first place. Maybe he did. But you're seeing a personality dominate world events. And Europe doesn't really have that. You've got... this has really exposed Europe's leadership void. And you've got Chancellor Olaf Scholz's opinion rating absolutely plummeting. The whole entire German coalition, nobody is really a big fan of. And it's getting a lot of people saying, well, we need a strong leader. I think there was this talk show that he was on, and he said, well, what really scares me is this incredible emphasis on geopolitics and the thinking of the Russian president. And a lot of German politics at the time, this was about a year ago, they were like, wait, what? Did our chancellor just say he's scared of Vladimir Putin? You had people making the point in the press that, okay, well, at least Neville Chamberlain never actually said, well, what scares me about Adolf Hitler? Like, Chamberlain never at least admitted to being scared of Hitler. And there's a lot of people saying, well, we need someone different. A Green Party politician who is part of Scholz's coalition said that statement was like a punch in the stomach. Whenever the world looks at him, you can see that he's so scared and overwhelmed, she wrote. And I think this is what you're seeing. Germany had their big announcement, their winds of change, or whatever the particular German phrase was, the 100 billion. And people love that. That was probably the high point of Olaf Scholz's time in office. He got a standing ovation from both sides of the houses of the Bundestag. But he never followed up with anything so bold. I mean, you really felt that appetite for bold leadership and how much people got a taste of that and they loved it. And then it never really came back from Olaf Scholz. So we're seeing that vacuum. And I think this is a way where all of these different things are dramatic ways that prophecy has been fulfilled already in this crisis. I mean, this is where we're seeing prophecy still to be fulfilled. In 2014, Mr. Flurry wrote, a second major prophecy that Russia's invasion of Ukraine will bring about is the arrival of a new strongman in Europe. And this was back when Russia first invaded in 2014. He said, a new leader is coming, a kind of Vladimir Putin. This is what Europe needs in order to bind together, to have the strength and unity of purpose needed to confront Russia. Europe's new fear of Russia is going to play a major role in hastening the fulfillment of that prophecy. There's a forecast, and I think we're seeing it on the way to being fulfilled. We're seeing the appetite for that strong leader already. And that built on what Herbert W. Armstrong wrote decades later in the 1950 Plain Truth. He wrote, "Most important of all is the outlook from here for continental drift at Washington. Tough talk, but no tough action. The nations of Europe directly in the shadow of the great Russian bear are becoming very disturbed, distrustful of America, and thinking more and more about uniting themselves into a United States of Europe. All that is lacking now is for the new supreme leader to rise up and to assert himself and take command. The stage is all set, and while we totter perilously on the very brink of war with Russia, still our real danger is this coming United States of Europe, which will resurrect the ancient Roman Empire, and still we're not even cognizant of that danger." So this is increasing that appetite for a strong leader.
Yeah, and we did get a small taste of it. And around the beginning of 2023, actually, there was a female defense minister with name Christine Lambrecht in office as the defense minister, and she was ridiculed for sending 5,000 helmets to Ukraine when they were needing tanks, and was actually the media that put a lot of pressure on her, and then she resigned. And the next day, on January 17th, it was announced that Boris Pistorius would take up that leadership of the defense ministry. And he basically got into that office saying that $100 billion for the military is not enough. And everyone was cheering like, yes, we need more military focus. And they were celebrating him for that. And since then, he has been the most popular German politicians overall at this time. So you see the appetite for leadership has changed. They got a little bit of a taste of leadership, and suddenly he's the most popular defense minister, most popular politician, and anything he wants, the German people support him. He says Germany needs to become kriegstüchtig, capable of war, meaning our people have to go on war and our children have to die in a war, essentially, to defend ourselves. And the people that were reluctant after World War II, reluctant from so many Russian invasions, most notably, obviously, in World War II, but they really crushed the German people, because Germany is a brutal military force, but when the Russian strikes back, it has been even more brutal on the German populace. But now they're celebrating a leader that says, we have to be ready to fight.
I'm just looking up the latest opinion poll ratings of various different leaders on there. Boris Pistorius is the only one that has a net positive approval rating. At least these statistics are from April 2024. And that's out of people currently in government. It's also out of like Markus Söder and the main opposition leaders within Germany. The only one is Boris Pistorius, this defense minister that talks tough and talks about reviving that. Like there is a clear appetite for that kind of leadership. And that brings us to our ninth point that I think you were going to introduce about the way that Germany views its military is changing.
Yes, one of the biggest points that is very underreported is how Germany sees its military and the change in overall view on the military. We already talked about the view on the military leadership, but another big point is how Germany sees its arms industry. That's the industry that got Germany into World War I. It got Germany into World War II. That was the industry that actually financed the rise of Adolf Hitler. That same industry, the same company, some didn't even bother to change their name, like Rheinmetall, to call them out. They didn't even change the way they called their tanks. Still names according to Leopard, which is like a vicious animal. They called their tanks in World War II the same. The same military tradition continues. So it was a bit of a shame to work for some of those companies. But I talked to someone that works in the civil industry, more in the sector of developing cameras, very high advanced company too. But I said some colleagues openly talk about taking a contract from the military industry. And I've seen people from Rheinmetall on video saying like, yeah, now we can go into society and openly talk about the work that we are doing, as if that's a great thing with a history like that. So the way But the way it is right now is, well, that's the industry that's going to protect us in the end. So the Germans are seeing that industry not as the one that got all that cruelty on them, but now it's more seen as a savior when times get tough.
That's a really interesting example of just a complete change in all of society, really. And I think you see some of this happening at the political level. Again, it's not a coincidence that this is happening since the Ukraine invasion. So April 25th, the Bundeswehr voted to establish an annual Veterans Day that will be held every year on June 15th. There's never been that before. Because who are the veterans within Germany historically? Well, it's been, at least for the last few decades, it's been the soldiers that fought for the Nazis. So they've not had a Veterans Day. Now, though, with what's going on in Ukraine, there's this changing view. Again, the soldiers, the military, they're the ones that keep us safe. May 15th, I think you had preliminary celebrations taking place in Berlin. The Christian Democratic Union has been putting forward their proposal where they want, I think, more military, more patriotic images in around the Bundeswehr to increase the sense of patriotism in the politicians. They've pushed for more military holidays as well. So this is this is less tangible, which is why we kind of have to reach for, say, more anecdotes of, well, somebody says this is how I'm being treated in German society is changing. But that doesn't make it less real, and it doesn't make it less important. This is a shift happening across German society in the way that they view their military. And it's happening because of the invasion of Ukraine. And so we're getting again to a position where it's making the German military much more usable, much more a part of society, and a tool that can and will be reached for more in the future than it has been since the end of World War II.
Yeah, and those examples that you just pointed out too, they show that this is a strategic change. It's responding to Ukraine, but also Germany has a history of propaganda warfare, and it has started on the German people. It's a systematic change, like a word like Kriegstüchtig, where I say Germany has to be war capable. It's not enough to say it's defense capable. It's a small change, but it changes your mentality. And then even the German health minister, Lauterbach, he was saying that the German health system, which is one of the most advanced in the world, again, they pump a lot of money into it, but they said it has to become ready to help all those soldiers and be ready to take on any civilian casualties. So you get those messages after messages after messages. And it's not like Russia is about to invade Germany. Germany has doubled the population. It has nuclear weapons stationed from America on the ground. There are Poland in between and other countries in between. Russia is struggling to take on Ukraine. Russia is not going to be able to take on many other countries. So the threat is not as imminent. But if you look at the headlines, you see that Germany is prepared to be ready for warfare.
And our final point relates to a whole bunch of European countries preparing to be ready for warfare. And that is this reintroduction of conscription. I think this is something that is very tangible and measurable, where a whole host of countries, they ended conscription after the Cold War, and now they're bringing it back. I think Lithuania was one of the first. Back in 2015, they brought back mandatory military service due to the, quote, changing geopolitical situation. So they've moved already. Sweden, they drafted 7,000 people in 2024. They're going to draft 8,000 next year. Latvia abolished compulsory military service in 2006. They brought it back, I think it was this January. Norway is doubling its defense budget. They're adding 20,000 conscripts. And then Europe, or Germany itself, is talking more and more about conscription. They ended their conscription in I think it was about 2010, 2011, sometime around there. And their first major tentative step, I think, was announced June 12th, where Boris Pistorius said, well, they're going to send out a questionnaire to all young men. They'll have to answer this questionnaire. I think women can if they want. And it's going to ask about their interest and ability to serve in the military, basically. And then the military will use this questionnaire to select recruits for 6 months of service, with then the option to voluntarily extend their service to 2 years. But more and more European countries are saying, we need more people in our armed forces. We need a bigger military. And they're looking for something that it was kind of viewed as an archaic relic of the Cold War, to provide that answer.
Yeah, and in the case of Germany, they say that the 100 billion won't be enough. And the former German defense minister, he was the one that ended conscription. He said we need to focus on the foreign wars because we don't have to defend Germany anymore. That's past us, you said. But he's saying if we introduce it again, tens and billions need to flow into the country again. But if you look at example like Egypt can have a conscription and they don't do it. Israel obviously can do that with a much smaller budget. But you see that that also is like what goes back to we need to change the mentality of the German people. Like each one of you has to be prepared for warfare and we need to get a budget into it.
So that is our top 10 list of how Europe has been transformed after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And I think the big thing to emphasize there is just, you take a step back, it really is impressive how much it has changed. And like we set up at the start, those changes were forecast specifically. Herbert W. Armstrong and now Sir Gerald Flurry, they both said, watch for Europe to change in these very specific ways due to Russian aggression. And we have seen this exactly. It has already played out. Yes, there's more to happen, but so much has already played out. And those men didn't say that because of superior geopolitical analysis. It is all based on Bible prophecy. And that's why it's important to step back and look at how this has already happened, because this is showing you, you can rely on Bible prophecy. And you look out in the world and you can find all kinds of crackpots that have their version of what Bible prophecy is going to say. And sometimes you see these in the newspapers. I think you see this, the Daily Express, they're always having articles, something to do with a red heifer in Israel or to do with blood moons. Or there's a lot of theories out there. And some of them are kind of weird and off the wall. But we're talking to you today about statements made on Bible prophecy that have already been proven true. If you look at Revelation chapter 13, and we have a prophecy of a beast power that's really a resurrection of the old Roman Empire, and the rest of Revelation 13 makes very clear it's one that's dominated by a church, a religious power. But it says in verse 4, and they worship the dragon which gave power unto the beast, and they worship the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? So if you can understand who this beast power is, if you can prove that background, you can know there's a prophecy here of a great war-making power. And Herbert W. Armstrong had a book where he showed this beast, it's very clearly referring to this European power. And so based on that prophecy, he made these forecasts. They're going to be Europe is going to become a major military power. But the Bible is a jigsaw puzzle. The Bible has lots of different pieces and lots of different parts that all give a little bit more of the picture. That gives you one aspect of Europe. But there are other prophecies that talk about Europe's dynamic with Russia. And, a jigsaw puzzle, Mr. Armstrong would make this analogy, and it's such a great analogy because it can be very hard to put the different pieces of the puzzle together. But once someone has done that for you, you can very easily check that that is correct. You don't have to take the other person's word for it that, these four or five puzzle pieces fit together. You can look and say, I see the picture. They very clearly connect. And so God revealed this truth to men in this end time, to Mr. Armstrong and then to Mr. Flurry. But you don't have to take their word for it. You can go and you can look at the jigsaw piece. You can see where they've put the pieces to the puzzle together. You can check it for yourself. You can prove it for yourself. And you can see that these statements have already been proven true. And so I think the piece of literature I would like to recommend that you read, if this has piqued your interest, if you want to learn more about these forecasts, is a little booklet, a little pamphlet we have called He Was Right. And that focuses on statements that Herbert W. Armstrong made based on revealed truth that have already been proven true. Some of them relate to Europe. He talked about, for example, how countries behind the Iron Curtain that were kind of locked into the Soviet Union would break away and become allied with Germany. That has happened. Germany is building a military base in one of those countries right now. So you can go and you can prove this and prove that these prophecies have already been fulfilled for yourself.
Yeah, just recently I had something like a he was right moment because my granddad, he was in the Worldwide Church of God under Mr. Armstrong. In fact, he was before that in World War II. He was drafted when he was 17 years old, and then he got into Russian captivity, one of the most brutal captivities in history, obviously, and he had nightmares up until his death. But then when he came to church, he learned about the truth of the Bible prophecy and what Mr. Armstrong forecasted. And he shared that what he understood with other people. And recently I went back on a trip in Germany, and I talked to one of the elderly ladies that was in contact with him. And after Russia invaded Ukraine, she remembered something that my granddad told her. And she said that he told her that unless Russia repents, it will invade another country again. So that's something that people didn't believe. Many people even saw with the rise of Vladimir Putin that he would change all that Cold War mentality. He would bring up more cooperation with Europe, and that we would never see a world like that again. But that statement was so unique from my granddad to her that she remembered that. And my granddad, he died 23 years ago. But till this day, this lady, who has no contact with the church whatsoever that we are part of, remembered that statement, and she saw it happening in front of her eyes. So that was one of those moments where I thought that this message, people are listening, and years later, they might see how the Bible prophecies are coming to pass.
And you may think, well, some of these prophecies, some of these forecasts, well, that doesn't sound maybe believable. It doesn't sound like this could happen. But just as you pointed out, like you go back 10, 15, 20 years, how many people would have said the same thing about the world events that we're seeing happening right now? You know, like a massive land war in Europe and Russia invading Ukraine and, you know, full-scale war. A lot of people 20 years ago would have said that's impossible. So when we see these forecasts proven true, it's a reminder, well, not to quickly write off what happens next. And so, yeah, go back and prove this prophecy reliable, and then look at what happens next. Because we do have a lot of very detailed things to say about the next step, and even pointing to individuals that could well fill, say, the strongman role within Germany, fill that appetite for a strong leader. And Mr. Flory's drawn a lot of attention to the former German defense minister, Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg, who has talked a lot about this conflict as someone that could fill that role.
Yes, and he left politics in 2011, but Mr. Flory still points to him as the most likely man to watch. And recently he has been becoming more and more public, and he has been asked what Germany needs to do and if he agrees if Germany needs to become war capable. In fact, he was the first one who said that Germany is engaged in a war already, and that was in Afghanistan, where they had a foreign mission there. It wasn't really a war because there weren't two states colliding against each other, but then he said, well, our soldiers feel like they're in a war. And it was him that tried to change the German mentality, where they thought, no, we try to be a defense force, we try to be at home, if at all we try to invest in defense that the Russian invasion wouldn't come, where he said no, Germany needs to think military, and they need to think geopolitically, where the threats are not just at home, we have to advance up front in other regions to tackle those. And Mr. Flory has talked about many specific Bible prophecies that say that Germany will have a specific military leader. And with the rise of Gutenberg, he pointed to those prophecies, saying this man will rise. And for 13 years now, after Gutenberg left office, he continues to point to those prophecies and to this man to watch. So when it comes to power, or man just like him, you can remember that prophecy.
There'll be a lot of future he was right moments. Well, I'll just leave you with one more quote from Herbert W. Armstrong. In 1981, he wrote, "When this Holy Roman Empire does happen, it will happen suddenly. So quickly it will take your breath. And the whole world will gasp in awe and wonder when they see the things that are prophesied. For example, 10 nations in Europe, probably 5 of them in the West, 5 in the East, resurrecting the so-called Holy Roman Empire of the Middle Ages." We're about to see this happen again. So much has already happened. Don't get caught by surprise when this happens quickly. Take the opportunity now to prove Bible prophecy for yourself and understand what comes next. And that booklet, He Was Right, is a great first step towards doing that. You can go to our website, thetrumpet.com. You can download it. You can order your own free print copy sent to you so that you can really study and dig into that and prove the Bible and help your Bible come alive. Thank you so much for joining me today, Joshua Michels, and for all the work that you put into this top 10 list. I think it's been a really fascinating episode.
Yeah, I enjoyed all the comments we had together.
And if you want to get in touch with us, we're still pretty new. We're still experimenting. We kind of, the first few Wednesday shows, we kind of had this three-segment routine. This week we've tried something a bit different. We've gone in depth for the full program on just one subject. Let us know what you like. If you are fed up with this subject after about 20 minutes, let us know. If you'd like to see us do this again, please do let us know. You can leave us comments on YouTube or on Rumble. You can send us an email, trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. Also, please don't forget about the liking, subscribing, all of that. That really does help us get this out. Thank you so much to George Haddad for engineering and production today on the show. We'll be back on Friday, and until then, keep watching your world.